To be in the last chapter of the Song of Solomon, chapter 8, if you want to go there in your Bible. And we're concluding this evening our study of the Song of Solomon. New classes begin a week from today.
Correct.
Right?
Go where you've been Wednesday night, but after that we're starting over on Sunday.
Yes, we start over on Sunday. And so instead of having text talk, we'll have three classes.
Right.
Brian's going to be in here.
Right. Brian Klutz.
Yeah, Brian Klutz doing a character study, talking about the Great Cloud of Witnesses. And then you're doing a class.
Right. I'm doing Revelation in the back somewhere.
Revelation.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to argue about a room back there. I've got the young adults.
Right.
Not that that's important because they're not in here right now. But so it'll be back to kind of a regular Bible class program. Yeah. Yeah. As it has been, of course, I haven't been here as it has been in the past, so I don't know what that looks like. I assume that's kind of what we used to do.
Usually we have a few more, not in the auditorium, but we're getting there.
We're getting there, gradually working our way back. So this will be our last Song of Solomon study.
Yes.
And we're hoping that you guys have found this to be profitable. Little bit of a tough book. I think you could make an argument that it's the toughest book in the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, starting Revelation next quarter, I'm looking forward to that as being easier. because seriously, that is actually, I've seen it in writing, and commentators have wrestled with this book, Jewish, Christian, over the centuries. This is because of the poetry, the abstractness, more than we realize. And even think about it this way, let's be honest, Revelation's taught more often in most congregations than this song is. And there's something about that as well. It's not just that the topic matter maybe makes us a little uncomfortable to talk about it in public, but it's a tough book to interpret, as you and I have found week by week in our weekly wrestling matches.
And as we'll find tonight, it in some ways it's like Revelation, in that we're dealing with language
imagery
that has symbols and figures, and so we got to spend some time trying to work through and figure out how to understand the symbolism.
Right.
Understand the poetry. So we're going to finish this up tonight, beginning in verse 5 of chapter 8. I think this, do you think this is one poem all the way to the end?
You mean from 8:5 all the way to the end, or you mean the whole song?
No. From chapter 8, verse 5 to the end of the chapter, verse 14.
You know, we talked, now that's not fair because we've talked about this just yesterday. I can go either way. I mean, that's part of what makes this song challenging. I mean, kind of like we talked about yesterday, verses 13 and 14 can almost be kind of riding off in the distance, the little teaser at the end of the credits of a movie or something.
It's helped me when I read the poems to imagine this as a scene in a play.
Yeah, that's right.
Sort of being acted out. And so if you were to look at chapter 8 that way, verse 5, look at the very beginning. Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved?
Right.
And so my understanding of that is that here is our couple that the poems have been centered around, right?
Yeah.
And so they kind of come out on the stage one last time.
Right.
And so they're going to tell us some stuff. And then at the end, in 13, he says to her, "Oh, you who sit in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it." And she says, "Hurry, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices." And so there's kind of this playful
banter.
A bit erotic exchange between them, which would be fitting for the book.
Well,
that sort of closes the curtain on the scene.
Well, and the beauty of it is, I mean, to your point, if you want to imagine this as almost like a movie scene, verse 5, coming up from the wilderness, leading on her beloved, that's the marriage has happened, they've developed some sexual chemistry, as we've been talking about the past couple of weeks, chapter 6, chapter 7, and, remember we talked before about, she wishes they were related so they could kiss in public. This is so, when you understand, we talked about that culture, you didn't publicly display affection between husband and wife in public, and the way that family could, that's ironic, because today's the exact opposite. We do PDA in public and hide the family stuff behind closed doors. It's kind of ironic. But anyway, so in public, for her to be seen this way, for them to be seen this way, it really brings out the intimacy that has developed. And then to your point, kind of at the end, but what they say too, he says, "Let me hear it," whereas before back in chapter 2 is, "Let me see your form." Well, he's seen that, now he just lives for the voice. And then her back in verse 14, that imagery of gazelle, stag, and mountain, that was back earlier in the book, David. That was chapter 1, chapter 2. when he's like a gazelle. So yeah, they're kind of back to, they have not lost the enamorment that they had for each other before the marriage. It's, if anything, deeper, she's leaning on him now. But we've come full circle. They're still enamored and deeply satisfied with what they have.
Which would add to this idea that I think we've been trying to emphasize all the way through, and that is that romantic love doesn't peak on the wedding night and gradually die the slow death over the life of a marriage, but that it's the intended plan of God for romantic love to be part of married life all the way through to the end. And even in saying that, it's not enough because it's supposed to grow richer and better all the way through.
Well, life. And so to that point, then, versus the cultural lie that many lovers and promiscuity is the glory to great sex, the irony is that, you know, here the picture is sexual love deepens and gets better over time. And if you're sexual in one sense, you know, the mark of a marriage that and sexuality abused is it doesn't become more desirable with that one person.
Well, so we need to finish up 8 tonight, and we're going to work this in 2 segments. You can read and decide if you think it's 2 poems or not. Jeff and I gave up debating back and forth about this week. So from 5 to 7, we'll work that segment a little bit. And then from, 8 to about 12, we'll work that segment a little bit. And really, the reason we put these into 2 segments is I think that in each of them, there is a different message that sort of ties back to the theme of the whole book. And so in 5, 6, and 7, I think there's a message there about love and what love really is.
Yeah.
And then in the 2nd segment, there's a message about purity.
Absolutely.
Which have been ideas and themes all the way through the poems that we find throughout the book. Purity and love and what it's really all about.
Right.
So as we read this first segment together, this 5, 6, and 7, look back at the slide. I said look back at the slide. Look behind me at the slide. It doesn't work for me to look this way. It feels backward. Look at the slide and remember our first question. At this point, just think about what you see here, and then we'll work to figure out what it's all saying. So remember, they've walked on the scene in verse 5, and then the woman, who has been the key figure really throughout the book, she speaks and she says, "Beneath the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she was in labor and gave birth. Put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death, jealousy as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised." So, as we read through that, what'd you see? It's kind of confusing, isn't it? Sometimes when you read this, especially for the first time through, it just seems sort of disjointed thoughts, unconnected to each other, that don't form some kind of a cohesive message. I think that's one of the challenges when we read. So a couple of things to hang on to. First of all, something is born in verse 5.
And
it's born through labor, right? The high school class Wednesday night, especially perplexed right here. They were really struggling with that, trying to figure out what that was about. And then picking up in 6, we have this series of comments about love.
Yeah, 6 and 7 are almost a standalone poem within the poem on it. It's almost like a song or something.
Are you going to argue for 3 poems now?
No.
Okay,
no,
good.
I'm just saying.
Because that would throw off the whole night if you did that.
I saved the best for last.
So let's talk about what... let's talk about this birth in verse 5.
Okay.
What's going on?
Well, so you and I have wrestled over that. And I think, both of our views kind of, I think, can be teased out of it. For my part, I tend to see it as, and I mentioned this before, in other sessions, in the ancient world, sex naturally led to marriage. Marriage naturally led to sex. Sex naturally led to childbirth. Boy, get that straight in a sec.
Sequence matters.
Sequence matters. The old playground chant some of us remember when we were kids, first comes love, then comes marriage, then what? Then comes the baby carriage. And for most of human history, think about, you know, too, this is the ancient Jewish world. What's a big deal? Genealogy, right? What tribe you're from? What family you're from? What are they looking for? Son of David down the line's got to come, right? The Messiah's coming. So, you know, so childbirth matters. And so, you know, in my reading, I've completely convinced you of this yet, but I think they're the apple tree as a symbol of fertility, a luscious fruit often associated with prosperity and fertility. What's happening is, you know, she sees them, they have come full circle. Deep enough in the marriage, think about having kids as that initial marital sexual enjoyment of each other gives way to what the natural fruits of a sexual life in marriage brings. And so where your mother gave birth to you is where we are, not literally, but metaphorically. We've come to that point in the circle of life now. Your parents gave birth to you, and now you will, through me, father your own children. I will be the mother, you will be the father. And so a natural progression in their relationship as the book kind of, which was focused more on the sexual intimacy itself, comes to a close. To just double down on, this is where we are.
Yeah, that's not what I see.
I know. So it's your turn.
So can we give you all an alternate view? Will that just mess everything up if Jeff and I don't agree
about
this?
That's the beauty of poetry, man. That's why we do this.
So the question is, what is awakened?
Right.
And what is born?
Right.
And so when you look at what follows in the conversation about love, I see love being awakened here. That's really what the poems in the book have been about, going back to the beginning. The awakening of love between these two people, which we talked about this in class on Wednesday night. Kids were fascinated about the idea of falling in love being compared to childbirth and labor. But I want you to think about it. Hadn't it been a little bit that way as we've walked through these poems? There were some hard dimensions to falling in love. So we think about some of those early fears she had. Remember the little foxes in chapter 2 that symbolize the things that threaten the relationship, or the dream sequence at the beginning of 3 where she fears losing him? All of that is part of falling in love. And so, you know, one of the things I think this segment is doing is giving us a, Brother Tomlinson would say, I love having an opportunity to use this word, a more robust understanding of what love is and what it's all about, and the fact that there are some hard dimensions to it.
Yeah, the movies always stop with the wedding. Nobody ever focuses on the marriage, and that's what the book does.
And and so we have seen that even after the marriage vision in chapter 4, some of their struggles after that. So you can consider the different views you've heard and wrestle yourself with the poetry and see what you see. But I see the awakening of love, which has kind of been the message of the poems all the way through the book, as what's being described in 6. But then moving on, we have this, shall we call it a description of romantic love? Is that the right way to say that?
Sure. Yeah.
So set me as a, look at verse 6, set me as a seal over your heart like a seal on your arm. Maybe we should talk a little bit about sealing. I think that's a struggle for us because it's not common in our culture.
Right. No, yeah, I mean, the ancient world, sealing was a mark of ownership and authenticity. You think about the king's ring and the king would seal. I think about the place in Jeremiah where God was so frustrated with Israel and with her king, though Coniah was a signet ring, I would take it off and throw it away. And that's powerful because that's the mark of God's authority, you know, kind of God's, even if that's how close you were to me. I'd throw that ring away. So the seal is the idea of ownership and authenticity. And that's what she wants here, right? She wants to be a seal upon your heart. What does a woman deep down want from her husband more than anything else? She wants to know that she is his.
And that actually, that's been an idea that we've traced all the way through the book. That's one of the threads in this tapestry, because if you go back to chapter 2, look back for a minute to chapter 2 and verse 16. Do you remember this? Chapter 2, 16, my beloved is mine and I am his. Remember that? And that's not the only time we've seen that. It kind of comes in some different versions 2 other times in the book. But the idea is we belong together, we belong to each other, that romantic love has this possessive quality. Right. And I don't mean possessive in the worst sense of that. Right. I mean no, possessive in the best sense of that. We belong together.
My beloved is mine and I am his.
And in fact, it made me think of 1 Corinthians 7, because this idea is in the New Testament as well, where he talks about how the husband doesn't have authority over his body, but the wife.
Right.
And the wife doesn't have authority over her body, but the husband.
Right.
And in that sense of we belong to each other.
Right.
So that idea of ownership.
Right. And again, you know, you can also push this back to our culture's lives, especially to our young people about sex. You know, real sexual fulfillment comes in commitment. You know, commitment leads to romance, leads to true sexual fulfillment, not the other way around. In fact, sexual fulfillment outside the commitment of marriage makes this kind of romantic love really almost impossible. You know, yeah, maybe you have a friend who's been shacked up for 15 years. That's the exception to the rule. That's not how it works in the world. That's not how it's made to work. And so commitment leads to romance, leads to sexual fulfillment. And that's what she's speaking to here, this possessiveness.
In fact, I'd love that she goes on to say, for love is as strong as death.
Yep. That's a vivid image.
It is, because and the kids struggled with this in class too. You know, what does that mean? And I think the point is that once death gets its hands around you, it doesn't let go, right?
It's never satisfied till it possesses you completely.
Right. And so there is that sense that we belong together and we're not going to let go, which again threads all the way back through this book. We've seen that again
right.
and again and again. This idea that we belong together and we're sticking it out no matter what comes.
Right, right. And that parallel line right below it then, right? Jealousy is as fierce as the grave. Same type of idea where jealousy, you know, what is jealousy? It's a better a desire. And so the desire is never satisfied till, you know, death is never satisfied till it has you in the grave. That's when death is fulfilled in its desire for you. And so it's a little bit morbid, but I think part of what we got to remind ourselves too is in the Bible, love and sex, these are serious things. We treat them trivially, shallowly, sentimentally, and sillily in our culture. But in the Bible, this is life and death foundation aspects of being human. As much as being born and dying, love and sex and marriage are foundational to human flourishing and the meaning of human life as well. And I think part of, you know, what happens in our culture is that gets obscured sometimes. You know, we use work or pleasure, entertainment as solaces for the lack of a healthy marriage or that kind of life and that kind of love and fulfillment. But there it is. These are foundational aspects of human existence.
So are you getting ahead of me? Did
Probably.
You talk about jealousy?
A little bit.
Because that's the next thought. Mm-hmm. For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are the flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Now, Jeff and I talked about this week, and I'm afraid that we're probably going to part company here too. But it'll be the last time tonight, I think. Because to me, jealousy now is the counterbalance to this possessive quality of love, because we belong together and it's together forever.
Right.
You have this possessive quality. You also have this exclusive quality that goes along with it.
Absolutely.
That because we belong together, you don't need to be with anybody else.
Right.
And I thought about Proverbs 6. You know, Proverbs 5, 6, and 7 deal a lot with sexual purity. Let me go away from the song just for a minute and ask you to look at something in Proverbs 6. This is Proverbs 6. Look down at verse 32, because this is a relationship or envisions a relationship where that exclusive quality isn't present
right.
and the bond is violated. The wise man warns, the one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Wounds and disgrace he will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. For jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor will he be satisfied, though you give many gifts. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
That when you have that real bond with someone, that bond is violated, the consequences are terrible.
Well, and to your point, the very next thing that happens in chapter 7 of Proverbs is he tells a story about a foolish young man lacking in sense who is tempted by an adulterous woman whose husband is out of town, and the young man gives into the adulteress's temptations, commits the immoral act with her. The husband comes home early, and in a very vivid point in Proverbs chapter 7, finds an arrow in his liver. He did not know what would cost him his life.
Yeah.
Because the jilted husband, enraged at finding his wife in the arms of another man, kills the man. Ironically, not the woman.
So there is that expectation of exclusivity.
There is.
To this relationship.
Yep.
It's me and you together for life and nobody else.
Right.
As God designed it to be.
Right.
And so when that's violated, it's interesting that with all the sexual mores that have violated in our culture, this one has kind of hung on. You study changing moral values, and I will tell you that one of them that hasn't statistically changed that much, people still disapprove of adultery.
Yeah.
In very high numbers.
Yep.
So that sense that we belong together and this is exclusive, you shouldn't be looking at other people, forsaking all others, we say
right.
In the vow. That's expected, even in our culture today.
It is ironic.
Well, okay, so pressing on beyond that.
Are we going to do the last part of verse 6 there, too?
The flashes.
Yeah, or the flashes
fire.
Of fire, the very flame of the Lord.
No, go ahead.
Oh,
jump on that.
Okay. Because I actually, for years, I have used verses 6 and 7 in wedding sermons sometimes, because I think it's a great description of love. You know, you get something besides 1 Corinthians 13 for a change at a wedding.
So you talk about the flame of the Lord during wedding vows.
Sometimes, yeah.
That must be a really interesting wedding.
Sometimes, I think that those lines kind of sit in the center of this whole little verse 6 and verse 7 summary of love. It sits right in the center. To capture the very, love, and especially sexual love, mere love between a man and a woman. You know, God knew then what we now know, in fact, which is, as Paul talks about, marriage is really an image of Christ in the church, right? And so it's literally an image of God's own love for his own people. And God creates marriage. It's not that, Paul is sitting there with the Holy Spirit helping him in Ephesians 5 in the first century saying, the marriage kind of looks like that. I think it's the other way around. When Paul says the mystery is great, I'm really talking about Christ in the church. What he's really saying is God built the world. God created the world so that when the time was right, Jesus had come. I could connect these dots. I made marriage to be an image of my eternal purpose. That, by the way, is why marriage goes away in the age to come. Remember, Jesus taught that. Why does it go away? Because the thing that it's an image of, a shadow of, has come to pass, Christ in the church. That's why there'll be no marriage in the age to come. Jesus taught that. And so it's really, we are meant to, in our marriages, image this jealous love of God for his people. What happened in the Old Testament when somebody messed with God's people? Well, there were consequences for that, right? God defended his people. Remember the promise to Abraham? Those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. Don't mess with my bride. Don't mess with my people. And so God comes crashing down on Pharaoh in Egypt. These are, this is my bride. These are my people. And so, when we get into marital love, sexual, we're dealing with something that's very powerful. We're dealing with something that literally is, it taps into God's own love for his people. And so there is, and that's why I think getting marriage and sex wrong does such damage to us. Even when somebody gets divorced scripturally, they're never happy about it. It does real emotional damage. It does real damage to them. It rips their soul. It damages the children. We're playing with literally the spark of God and the very nature of God's life in us. When we start to play with sex and marriage, at the very beginning, God said, let's make man in our image, male and female, he made them. And how do male and female fulfill our male and femaleness in marriage and producing children? And so it's a powerful center point to why sex and marriage are so powerful, even among the pagans. I mean, this stuff matters. To your point, even adultery is frowned upon. It's like we innately know there's something that's been joined here that should not be put asunder.
Well, so you have the fire in 6, followed by the water in 7.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So many waters cannot quench love, nor
right.
will rivers overflow it.
Exactly.
So there is also this enduring
yeah.
quality to true love.
Right. God's love for his people will never end. Our love for our spouse. That's the thing. We are imaging the divine reality, this very flash of divine fire in us.
So that's interesting that you draw that parallel again between us and God, because Because we know how many times we let him down.
That's right.
And how his love endures toward us.
That's right.
And so that is to parallel the love that we have for each other in our marriage.
That's right.
You know, the true love is going to survive the onslaught of the storms.
That's right.
And we've seen that in the poetry in this book. They've had their troubles.
That's right.
But the things that pulled them apart, their love pulled them back together.
The desire is unquenchable. Just like, you know, with God and the human race, God will have his people. Sin, treachery, spiritual adultery that we commit against him will not stop his love for us. And thus Paul can proclaim in Romans 8, what will separate us from the love of God? Nothing. And that's the point. And so we are called to, and again, that's why divorce is such a scandal, immorality is such a scandal. We are called to image God's own love into those we have vowed and made a covenant with in marriage, just like God made a covenant with his people.
And did that last piece at the end of verse 7, if a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised.
Yep.
So there is a priceless quality to love. You can't buy it.
No. That's exactly right. And it'd be a poor thing if you could. The best things in life, kind of like this morning with our salvation, not by gold and silver, but by the precious blood of Christ. The most important things cannot be quantified or qualified in that way.
Now that's going to be interesting because she's going to talk about Solomon and money later.
Right. You know, which I take as a dig on Solomon's approach to love and marriage. That's exactly right.
Not to get ahead.
I would never do that.
But this is the contrast to it.
That's exactly right.
You don't buy it with money.
That's right. Exactly.
It can only be freely given.
That's right.
By two people. So looking back on all of this, it's a really great opportunity to reflect on how love has been misunderstood in our culture versus the picture of it that's been painted throughout the book, not just here, but all the
way
through.
Right. And undergirding commitment, no matter what happens and who did what to who, when the commitment remains.
So I think our culture has distorted love. I think it especially has distorted what romantic love is all about. I think culturally we've supplanted romantic love for sexual satisfaction.
Yeah, that's right.
And so there's a selfishness, I think, that attached to that. It's about me and my desire and having my desire satisfied my way.
Right.
That's what's romantic love has become.
That's right. That's part of the pornographication of culture, as I call it.
Is that really a word? So that's the second time tonight you've used a word, and I wondered if it was a real word. I do that sometimes with Jeff.
I would not put that on a Scrabble.
I'm probably
board.
Bragging on my ignorance, but I think he makes up words sometimes.
Just checking you. No, but the pornographication of the culture is to make sex about shallow biological pleasure, selfishly oriented. So that, again, as we've talked about, if I could be going back to even the very beginning, one of the reasons our young people need this book and the perspective of this book is even if we get two virgins together on their wedding night, they're still probably coming into marriage and experiencing their own sexual awakening with pornographic expectations. Even though they never looked at porn seriously, this view of self-oriented sexual satisfaction so pervades the culture.
Well, and it just, along with that, missing the deeper dimensions of this that have been explored throughout the book, going back to the beginning, the time that they spent together and the loving communication that took place between them and the acts of caring that come out in the lines
of the praising, the constant praising of each other.
Yes, those critical pieces, which are, how am I going to say this, focused toward the other person doing right by them rather than them doing for me, which I think is completely backwards of the way culture has it today. And then the pieces we see here, the permanence of it, the enduring quality of it, no matter what life throws our way, we're in this together. All of these are knitting together this picture of what God has in mind when he talks about love.
The focus on the positives, not the negative in the other person.
So it occurred to me that two takeaways from that. The first one is that we need to be encouraging our kids to marry someone who gets this. In fact, maybe it would be even better to say that we need to be selling our kids on this and implanting this picture in their mind of what real romantic love is all about. And let them bring that expectation when they're trying to find a spouse.
But what that means is we've got to be having probably more than many of us have had and probably more than some of us are comfortable with, having more frank conversations with our kids about these things. and talking openly and honestly, not just about you need to marry a Christian or something like that, but really getting specific. And even there, you know, the reference to, you know, the mother and learning from the mother and whatnot, you know, teaching our kids as they actually get old enough to anticipate or enter into marriage, you know, having some of those bride and groom talks with them about some of this stuff, rather than just letting the culture educate them even about the finer points of the sexual awakening that's about to take place.
Well, and so then the other piece of that, I think, would be to model that before our kids, to cultivate not culture's perception of what romantic love is in marriage, but to grab God's picture and work that, to make that what right. is true in our marriage, so that our kids aren't just taught this in theory, but it's being lived out before them by their mom and dad.
Right.
And so what an awesome opportunity to hear the message, but to see what it looks like
right.
in a real relationship.
Absolutely.
And so I think vital to that is we got to get back to books like this. It's why it's so important not just to pass by this book because it's difficult, but to work here to see if we can draw out those critical messages that define what we should be doing and also help us better understand what we need to be saying to our children. Okay, why don't we move on to this second segment. I'm watching the clock back there. We got about 20 minutes left, and we need to cover 8. Why don't we do 8 through 12, since we've commented on 13 and 14. You want to read that one?
Sure. We have a little sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. To which the woman answers, I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. And then I was in his eyes as one who finds peace. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon, and he let out the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, my very own, is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and the keepers of the fruit 200.
So this one kind of freaked the kids out Wednesday night. I got a few snickers by some of the stuff that is here. Again, at first glance, it's kind of just strange.
Yeah.
Particularly verses 8 and 9. It looks like we have a new group speaking.
Yeah.
Verses 8 and 9 that
we not the daughters before. Of Jerusalem.
No, it appears to be the brothers of the
right.
girl.
Correct.
That we've been following.
Correct.
Through the poems. And then she's going to speak beginning in verse 10. And that gets really interesting because she starts talking about Solomon.
Yep.
And then we close in 13 and 14 with that playful exchange. So let's see if we can figure out what all of that is talking about. I think 8 and 9, if you can just get past the awkwardness of what's said.
Right.
I think the message is pretty clear here. It's looking backward in time.
Yes.
To yes. the time when the girl in the poems in the book was a child.
Right.
And that's why he references her as having no breast. It means that she hadn't developed
yet. She's not mature yet.
Yeah, she's not mature yet, and that's the point that is being made.
Right.
And her brothers are thinking about that time when she will get married, and they're concerned with protecting the purity.
Correct.
Which brings us to the wall and the door.
That's right. If she's a wall, we'll build a battlement of silver. And if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. You know, basically, you know, the wall is a boundary. The wall is a protection. Keep some things in, keep some things out. And the door is how you get in and out of the wall. And so, yeah, I agree with you, David. I think the brothers are basically taking responsibility for their sister's sexual purity. You know, we tend to think about individuals and moral choices, and ultimately individuals are responsible for their own choices, right? But there is a sense in which, you know, there is the family's responsibility as well. I think about back under the old law, if a woman got married under the law of Moses and her husband discovers she's not a virgin on their wedding night, she was to be brought to her father's house and stoned. Why? Because in a sense, the men in her life, her father and her brothers, had not successfully helped her preserve her sexual purity. And so, yeah, it's a little bit different for the way we think about it, but the family had a role in helping a young girl protect her virginity. And the failure of that was a reflection on the men as much as it was the women.
And in fact, in this case, what they would do would depend on what kind of person she proved
correct.
To be. So if she was a wall, if she was virtuous,
right?
Well, their goal would be to reinforce her.
Fortify it.
In her.
That's what the battlement on the wall is. Yeah.
In her purity.
Right.
And if she's a door.
Wall it up.
Yeah, meaning.
Board the door up.
Meaning that she was promiscuous.
Yeah, right. And you need to close that door.
It makes me go back and think of the imagery of the garden back in chapter 4, mm-hmm. where the garden has a wall around it,
yep.
and the husband is invited in on the wedding night,
right.
except in this case,
right.
the door is open at a time it shouldn't be.
Because gardens are always cultivated. If you try to have a garden without some sort of border in your yard, what happens? The grass takes over, the weeds take over, whatever. So yeah, virginity has to be protected then and now. And there is a role for the family to play that. I mean, you know, sometimes our kids don't want us in their business, but the fact of the matter is the brothers knew. And by extension, in the old law, fathers were accountable for maintaining their daughter's virginity.
So this is not justification to lock your children away until they're old enough to marry, right?
No.
That's not what you're saying.
No, no.
As tempting as it may be.
Yeah, don't look at me that way.
You got three daughters, man. I'm just wondering.
I know.
The point, though.
If only it were that simple.
The point was that the purity is to be protected.
That's right.
And the family had a role ensuring that she brought her purity to her wedding.
Again, especially when she's younger. I mean, that whole image of her and her immaturity, you know, to raise her that way, to cultivate in her an understanding of the importance of this in a world in which she could very easily go the other way, that she was to be, you know, both protected, but even taught, nurtured, shaped in this way, so that when we get to the next bit, she in her adulthood can take ownership for it and say, I'm a wall.
That's interesting that you made the comment, in a day with it, she could go either way. I guess that the struggle with sexual purity has always been true in every time.
Oh, absolutely.
Don't you sometimes feel like we're just living in days where that is particularly difficult?
Right.
And maybe that's even so, but there's never been a time when this wasn't a struggle.
Oh, no. No, I mean, you know, this whole idea of, you know, the Victorian age of, you know, everybody was being sexually moral. That was literally a myth they told themselves about themselves behind closed doors, as decadent as anywhere else.
Okay, so then we get to verse 10, and she's not a little girl anymore.
That's right.
And again, they use the figure of the breast to illustrate that.
Right,
but
that the point she's is, she's mature now.
Now she's grown up, and she comments about herself. She says, I was a wall.
Right.
Meaning?
Right. I protected my virginity. Nobody who shouldn't be inside got inside.
I was virtuous.
That's right.
So she protected her virginity until her wedding
right.
night. In essence, what she says is that she had embraced God's design for sex.
That's
in
right.
In fact, I think that's kind of one of the messages really all the way through the book, that she is doing this God's way.
Yeah.
And interesting that verse 10 ends with the word peace.
Yeah, you know, so then I was in his eyes. I think that to be her husband. Then that, you know, I bring myself to the marriage as a virgin. And so I was in his eyes as one who finds peace. And so here's the funny thing about that. You and I talked about this yesterday. That word peace there goes a couple of directions. Number one, in Hebrew, peace could just mean well-being, flourishing. This is how I flourish in my sexual awakening, in my marriage. I get to go into marriage and sexual life with no regrets, no baggage, no, you know, no shame on my family, none of that. But also, the word peace is the same Hebrew word as the word Solomon. And so there's a word play on what we're about to enter into here, which is this commentary on Solomon. Because in Hebrew, the word peace, shalom, in the Hebrew, the name Solomon, Shlomo, they're the same root. They even sound a little bit alike when you're speaking in Hebrew. And so she's also setting up the contrast she's about to make.
Yeah, and I'm like you. I'm tempted to do several different things with the word peace there. In one sense, once she has finished the journey into her marriage with her purity... Mm-hmm. There is a peace that just comes with that. The struggle is over, and now she is in a relationship
That's
where
right.
sexual intimacy can be expressed as God intended.
Right.
And so that struggle is over, which, by the way, is a great message for our kids.
Right.
Yes, you'll struggle this for a time, but then you enter marriage where that's the plan of God for
yeah.
sexual activity to happen.
Well, that's even Paul's point. You referenced 1 Corinthians 7 earlier. That's part of Paul's point in that passage. Better to get married than to burn.
And, but then I'm drawn, too, to the idea that because she made those choices, there's a peace that comes with that. It's interesting to dig into the statistical data, because while our culture argues that it really doesn't matter whether you're pure before marriage or not, I got to tell you, every bit of statistical data tells you that's not true.
Right.
The more promiscuous a person is prior to marriage, the more trouble they have in marriage and throughout their life. That's a statistical fact, which she's not going to experience.
Right.
Because she's done this the right way.
Right.
So I'm also curious about the connection to Solomon. So talk a little bit about that. What is she doing with Solomon here in verses 11 and 12? Yeah. Why does he suddenly enter the picture?
Well, you know, we've talked about before, you know, and especially in the Old Testament, he's the quintessential opposite of married monogamous love, right? How many women did Solomon have? 1,000 women. And so Solomon doesn't know, and Solomon is literally an example of, you know, and actually the destruction that can come to one's life, ironically, by marrying not just the wrong woman, but the wrong women. And so here, what you have here, I think, is a contrast. If she is this woman who has protected virginity, as we saw in verses 5 through 7, sings of that possessive love of one man, one woman for life, and that kind of commitment, Solomon's the opposite. And so Solomon has a vineyard. What's the image of the vineyard in the song? It's sexuality. It's this sexual experience.
Right.
Solomon has a vineyard at Baal Hamon. I'll come back to that one in just a second, what that place or what that designation means. But he let out the vineyard to keepers. You know, in the song, who gets to go into the woman's vineyard? Just her husband. But when you got as many women as Solomon has, what do you need? You need some eunuchs to watch the harem. This is not exactly private romantic marital bliss, is it? You need keepers for all the women in your life, eunuchs to guard the harem. Solomon's living a very, you know, degraded vineyard. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. Oh, that number 1,000, that's not chosen at random. That's kind of a riff on how many women Solomon had. And go back to now Baal Hamon. We don't read or know Hebrew anymore, but this is a pun. Hamon could mean something like a large crowd, or the noise that a large crowd creates, or the tumult that a large crowd can make, kind of the uproar. And Baal in Hebrew simply means Lord. So Solomon had a vineyard. He had his sexual life in a place called Lord of Chaos, as I like to translate it. That's what Solomon's sexual life was, because he did not practice one man, one woman for life. And so she kind of chides him. You've got keepers for your vineyard. It's not private. You know, you have eunuchs who watch your harem. And if love was priceless to her, you know, Solomon's 1,000 pieces kind of undergirds the whole. He doesn't really love any of them, because we're not made to love in that way. No man could actually love 1,000 women. And then comes the contrast. My vineyard, my sexuality, my very own is before me. You, O Solomon, may have the 1,000. It's kind of a rejection and a rebuke of that approach to marital love.
That's interesting what you said. I'm going to call it Baal Hamon, because that's the way the rest of us say
that. Baal Hamon. It's so much more fun to say it that way.
Yeah, I'm never going to get that. But you define that as Lord of Chaos.
Yeah.
So think about how that contrasts with the end of verse 10.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right up next to
peace.
It.
Peace. And that's the point.
I'm the one who finds peace. You are the one who's found chaos. And really, if you read Solomon's story,
right,
that's exactly how it mapped
out. Oh, yeah.
The many women were not a blessing to him.
They turned his heart from the Lord, and so the irony is, rather than he being the head leader of his household, pointing his family towards godliness, 1,000 women ran his life.
Yeah.
And it's tragic.
So I think you and I have been tempted all the way through this to see the Song of Solomon as a repudiation of his polygamy,
right,
which may be why it bears his name.
Yeah, that's right. Correct.
It's the Bible's answer to his bad behavior.
That's right. You know, whether it was written by Solomon as an act of penitence, or whether it was written about Solomon, which is what that original Hebrew title could also mean, as a rebuke of his lifestyle. Either way, Solomon comes off poorly in the final analysis, chapter 8, end of the poem. He comes out tragically and poorly. And so she has found peace. He has chaos. And one last thing about that pun, that play that's going on there in Hebrew that we're teasing out between verse 10 and verse 11. What we've got to underscore to our young people as well, David, is that peace in marriage is not you never have setbacks or problems, right? Chapter 5 was your chapter 6. That's right. Not peace. Peace is not the absence of speed bumps and turbulence. But peace is the flourishing that still comes even through the speed bumps and turbulence, because the commitment, the exclusivity, the desire remains and pulls us through that. And so we actually come out stronger, better, healthier on the other side.
And I think that message is just as true for people who would practice, let me see if I can use this without getting in trouble, their own version of polygamy today. Mm. It may not be that people marry a bunch of people, but they are sexually intimate with many different partners.
Serial monogamists.
And our culture has come to believe that is the way to go.
Until you find the right one.
In fact, it's popular to say, part of the mantra about sex is for people to say, oh, I could never imagine just being with one person my whole life.
Right.
Which, hear that for what it is, folks. That is an utter repudiation of sex as God designed it.
Right.
God didn't design this the right way. We were not meant to be with one person the whole life. So here you have the contrast between the nameless Shulamite in the story and the great King Solomon.
Right.
Who did it the right way.
That's right. And he had all the wealth and all the power and everything else, but knew nothing about this.
So he ended up with the mess, and she ended up with shalom.
Yeah, Baal Hamon versus shalom. That's right.
So if you take that and then start reflecting, I think there's some really important lessons to us, but fundamentally, I think the question to be answered is, whose voice are we going to hear on this? Because culture is certainly saying something to us about sex.
Oh, well, it's obsessed about it now. In fact, it's made it the thing with which you can't live without as much as you can, as often as you can, as early as you can, with whoever you can. I mean, it's not even about man and woman anymore. I mean, we have just become so sex-obsessed in the most crass and animalistic ways.
And that message is finding its way through so many different venues, sometimes really subtly, into our life. I mean, so it's a crowd out there who speaks to us about this. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was in high school talking to some guys I was working with. There were three of us who worked together, and somehow we got off onto this subject. And I remember telling the guys that I planned to be a virgin until I got married. That's what they did.
I was going to say, you got a reaction.
They laughed at me, literally.
I was laughing with you.
It didn't feel that way.
But that is the reaction.
Listen, that goes back a way, guys. It's been a long time since I was 17.
That's right.
And even then, I mean, that was an absurd notion. So there is the message of the crowd of people from out there in the world. But probably the more subtle ways that the message gets into us. Think about how many times sex as God planned it is displayed for us in a television show or in a movie.
Right.
You don't ever see that message.
No, the model is the complete opposite.
And then you have what I think is even worse than that, and that is the utter perversion of what sex is that is now being fed to our young people through pornography.
Right.
Because
sex is being turned in and of itself. It's sex without the other person even now is what it really is. All you need is an image to stimulate, and then you can satisfy yourself.
So... just in all kinds of different ways, there are all these different voices speaking to us about this topic, and the vast majority of time, the message is wrong.
Right, and part of what those images all do, David, is the nature of the desire they stimulate, because they do not stimulate the desire for selfless union with another, but rather selfish satisfaction of my own desires. And so you stop thinking about it. It's not just the image they give us, it's the desire they shape, what they make you desire. To the point, like you and I have talked about, you know, with young men who struggle with porn addiction and overcoming it, it has so warped their sexual desires that even repenting of the sin when they enter into a marriage, they struggle to find sexual satisfaction with their spouse because the desire itself has been so corrupted. And moms and dads, that's happening more, even if your child's not porn addicted, as such. The culture and all of its sexual messaging is shaping desires in our kids now as far as what they're looking for and what they're expecting when they get married.
Right. And so then contrast that with the message we get from God, which, frankly, guys, that's what makes this book so important. It's why every young person among us needs to read the Song of Solomon, and then after they've snickered about it, have someone explain to them what the message of the book is. Because I don't know that we have another place in the Bible where you have this collection of what essentially is God's plan, God's design for the sexual relationship, collected as it is here in these poems.
Right.
And man, our kids need to understand that. They need to get that. And so we have the world's message, we have God's message, and then we have something else that I think is a critical dimension of this. We have the opportunity to watch as culture plays out a plan other than God's, and see how that works.
Well, we're already starting to see that with all the, you know, the addictions, the depression, the frustration that so many people struggle with in the world because of the brokenness of their marriages, their homes, their families, the sexual damage they have incurred to themselves by playing with promiscuity or even more perverse forms of sexual activity, and they're finding they're not really fulfilled. They're really just destroyed. They're gutted. They're emptied.
Well, it's so. We have an opportunity to look and learn as people follow a different path and to see how destructive it is, how dismantling it is to culture. And listen, all of that's what we need to be telling our kids.
Absolutely.
They need that message.
And well, to your point, three daughters, one son, deep in the trenches of parenting in the middle of all this myself, we've got to remind ourselves as parents that our kids are being taught about sex, whether we want them to be or not. And so you might as well get involved in the conversation, no matter how awkward it is, because the culture is teaching our kids about sex. Their friends are doing it at school behind your back, and who knows what your kids are being taught at school, on the internet, the media you let them consume. And eventually, one way or the other, they're going to turn 18, 19, 20 years old. They're going to leave your house. And they're going to hear the world's version then, no matter how much you try to shelter them now. And so the culture's going to talk to our kids about sex. We've got to be doing that ourselves, as uncomfortable as we may be sometimes doing it.
Where else are they going to hear the truth?
That's the thing, is where are they ever going to hear this other message?
I mean, we did teach the class.
Right.
But frankly, folks, that's 3 months.
What do you do in 12 or 13 sessions?
Yeah. 12 or 13
versus
sessions.
Versus constant bombardment
and
otherwise.
And then... Randy and I, who taught the class, we can share what we think the message of the book is. We don't have an opportunity to engage and plug that in day by day as the questions arise and the challenges present themselves. So
that's right.
I really like the image of these brothers in 8 and 9, seeing themselves as having this responsibility. Family has a responsibility to help protect the purity of their children. And I think, listen, the thing that has fascinated me talking to kids about this for years and years is how many times I'm dealing with kids in the church whose mom and dad have said Zippo on the subject. I've had kids, I've talked to young men before, teenage boys, and I've had them ask me, I'm not really sure where to draw the line. I'm dating, we're getting familiar with each other. How far can you go before it's too far? You know what bugs me about that? Why is this kid asking me this question in Bible class? You got a teenage son who doesn't know where to draw that line? Listen, that's a mom and daddy problem. Mom and daddy need to be having that conversation at home. We cannot afford to be quiet on this. And yet still in this day and age, that's a problem.
That's right, because at the end of the day, the church's job is to be the church, and part of the church's job, part of you and I's job, part of the elders' job is to equip the saints for the work of ministry, which means equipping homes to act like homes, parents to act like parents, moms to be moms, dads to be dads, and raising your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Bible classes alone can't do it. The elders can't do it single-handedly. You and I can't preach enough sermons to do all this. It's got to be happening in the home.
Reinforcing that wall and closing that door.
Absolutely.
Well, we appreciate you guys letting us talk to you about this. Those of you with teenagers, thank you for letting us do the class and supporting us in that. And we hope that'll generate some conversation at home, which is the more important setting for talking about this. Let's have a prayer together, and that'll wrap up our study for tonight. God, we're grateful we could be together. We're grateful for the privilege of considering the poems in this critical book. May we take to heart the message. May it enrich our marriages. May it help us prepare our children to find your path in life as they wrestle with their sexual purity. We appreciate so much the guidance and direction you've given us on this vital topic. In Jesus' name, amen.